Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of Empire Podcast spoiler specials. This one is dedicated to Pirates of the Caribbean, : Salazar's Revenge, or if you're listening in the United States of America, Pirates of the Caribbean, : Dead Men Tell No Tales. It's the fifth and possibly final installment in the much-loved Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, the first since 2011's On Stranger Tides. And over the next hour or so, myself, James Dyer, and Helen O'Hara will be getting into the film in all sorts of mind-bogglingly spoilerific detail. So if you have not seen the film, stop. Don't listen to this. Go to the cinema, watch the movie, come back, and then listen to it. Make sense? Makes sense. Okay, but before you hear us talking about the film, I went recently to Disneyland Paris. Not just for shits and giggles, but to interview the directors of the film, Joachim Ronning, who looks a bit like Jurgen Klopp, the manager of Liverpool Football Club, by the way, and Espen Sandberg, and we spoke to them in great detail about the movie's many twists and turns, and they were a lot of fun. And by the way, we started off talking about the movie's biggest revelation, the presence of one Sir Paul McCartney. Enjoy.
We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Joachim Ronning and Espen Sandberg, directors of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Thank
Salazar's you. Revenge or Dead Men Tell No Tales? What do you prefer? Let's get this out in the open once and for all. What do you prefer?
I would say Dead Men Tell No Tales.
That's the title that we've had along. So, but something happened.
Exactly. I didn't even know that I didn't have the Salazar Revenge until I saw the poster from out of UK. So I didn't know what's that.
Somebody got creative.
Yeah. And so Javier got very happy. Javier Bardem, he was like,
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
More royalties for me.
Is that how it works? If you're name checked on the poster, you get more royalties?
It's like that's, when your characters.
That's why they had that man, so they didn't have to pay anyone.
Precisely. But the film, Dead Men Tell No Tales, works nicely. It is a theme that is dotted and studded all the way through the movie.
It's also from the original ride at Disney. That's what they say as you dive into the darkness
there. Yeah, as you make the first
drop there. Yeah.
Interesting.
They say, "Dead Men Tell No," and then you drop into this.
See, I haven't done it yet. We're here at Disneyland Paris, and I haven't yet done the Pirates of the Caribbean ride. So.
No, neither have we, actually. We just arrived, so we're going to do it now. I think they closed it down for us.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, yeah.
Oh, that's very nice. Yeah, they didn't close it down for me.
No. Usually they don't do it for us either. But they did it. We just came in from Shanghai, and they did it there as well. So getting used to it now.
Do you get Johnny coming out in costume on your ride? Is that what happens? Does he come out and
does he usually not do that?
I think he does it every day now. He likes it. It's something that's good for him. I want to start. Obviously, this is a spoiler special, so I want to talk with the big talking point of the movie, the one thing everyone's going to be talking about: Paul McCartney.
No,
huge Beatles fan.
What a treat. To have him, and to work with him. It's a funny story because, as you know, Keith Richard played the Jack Sparrow's dad in the series, of course. And we had a scene for him. We were ready to go, and then he couldn't do it from scheduling. Mm-hmm. And we were shooting in Australia, and it's like, it didn't work. So we sat down with Johnny and, made a very short list of potential substitutes because we really wanted it. It was something that the film could definitely be without it, but it's part of the franchise. It's part of this universe that we give you these kind of treats.
Yes.
At the very top of that list that we made was of course Sir Paul McCartney, and how do we get hold of him? And then Johnny like, Oh, I remember. I have his phone number. He went, and it's
as you do.
They're in the same club. Apparently,
I'm just checking my phone book.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have Paul McCartney's number.
No, exactly, and neither do we. He scrolled through it, and he started texting him, and he responded, and this went on for a couple of days back and forth, and the lingo became more and more piratey, and we realized that we got him. and we were so thrilled to have him and to shoot with him. He was such a professional, such a prince,
And such a great actor.
Yeah.
Well, he hasn't acted since, if I'm right in thinking, Give My Regards to Broad Street, which is a movie that put him off acting and everyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. And before that, it was probably Hard Day's Night, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right. And he loved putting on the pirate stuff. And, he put on too much of it. And he changed his accent. And we said, no... Because we got very nervous that nobody would recognize him.
Yeah.
They wouldn't see. And even now he's hard to. I don't think. I mean, half the room still don't see that it's him. I think.
Yeah.
So we were so happy he does his Liverpool, accent, and it's just one of those moments on this. Amazing journey. Yeah. Yeah.
And of course he is at the moment as we're talking. People only know him. Thanks to the internet, as Jail Guard 2. And that's not the truth. That's not the truth. He is Uncle Jack. Can you talk about that? I mean, because obviously he was meant to be Captain Teague, and then you had to change it.
Yeah, I mean, he's uncle. He's Jack Sparrow's uncle, which makes Keith his brother, I guess.
Quite the family tree.
It's like the coolest family tree. So we're bringing, Rolling Stones and Beatles together. And of course, we love that. And yeah. Johnny loved it. It was, those two together on, they're hilarious,
It's going to be one hell of a pirate supergroup when you get those guys together. Yep. You're going to have Captain Teague on guitar, Uncle Jack on bass.
Yeah. Jamming on the after party.
Johnny can play decent guitar as well.
He's very good.
This will be all right. Oh, one last Paul McCartney question before we move on to perhaps more plot significant stuff. We hear him before we see him, but we hear him singing Maggie May, mm-hmm. which is an old Liverpool folk song. And obviously John Lennon sings it on the Let It Be album. Yeah. Was that why you chose that? Is that...
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to answer this one too, and I'm going to let Espen answer some questions.
Yeah, no.
Again, talking about magic moments, shooting Pirates of the Caribbean. So on the day, we have Paul McCartney for one day, and it's a rush day, and it's a lot of pressure, I think, on us as well, because this is a scene we know will for sure end up in the movie, so it better be good. we wanted Paul to be singing in the jail scene. That so we hear him singing before we see him, and there we were discussing what song to sing, and of course he suggested this song, and it was the perfect song for it. And so we shoot the scene, and as you do at the end of the day, in order to get his singing recorded clean, we do a wild take of the just the vocal. So everybody on the stage, on the sound stage, they stop working. Everybody's standing still. We're behind our monitors listening in on our headsets, and we're recording Sir Paul McCartney, singing, and it doesn't get bigger than that in my book, at least. So,
it's an excellent moment. Excellent moment. Let's talk about the film itself then. And you bookend the film with Will, and then ultimately Will and Elizabeth, and you tie it very much into the first three movies. Was that something that you wanted to do going into this, specifically tie it back in?
Yeah, I mean, we wanted this movie to feel important to the fans, that this is a movie that you sort of need to see. Of course, we also wanted to work as a standalone movie, but we also know that there are millions of fans out there, and this is sort of a moment that they've been waiting for. So we really wanted to give them that.
Because the end of Pirates 3 with Will receiving the curse, that's a real kick in the teeth. I mean, so it's almost
a downer.
It's a real downer ending. Yeah. But it was important to you then to give that character some resolution.
Yeah, and to see them together again, to bring the band back together. And, we actually, the original script didn't have that scene. It didn't have Kira in it, didn't have Elizabeth Swann in it, and we just realized as we moved along and starting shooting with Orlando and starting shooting his scenes, and then realizing that, oh my God, we need to bring them back. We need to bring them back together. And as Espen is saying, I think a lot of people wants to see them back together. And so we asked Kira if she wanted to do it, and we were thrilled, and you know, when she said yes. But you know, she was shooting another movie in London, so we moved the production to London for a day. And shot them, you know. It was and again, one of those magical moments where, for us being fans of the franchise, seeing, you know, Will Turner and Elizabeth Swann hugging and kissing for a day, you know, it was amazing.
Hello, Kira. Yes, we want you to come back. You got to kiss Orlando for a day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then just lying there in bed.
Yeah, somebody has to do it.
It's tough. It's tough. You're in. Okay, great. We'll come to you. It's fine.
Exactly.
Did Kira take much persuasion, or was she okay with coming back?
No, it was very smooth.
Yeah.
Excellent. And she's also at the end of the movie in the post-credits sting, which I assume you guys directed. It's not like the Marvel movies where someone else...
Oh,
sometimes
do they?
Sometimes another director will direct those bits at the end.
No.
This movie feels very final to me. It feels like it is almost intended to be the last Pirates of the Caribbean movie. But the post-credits sting indicates that you might be leaving the door open, possibly...
Shouldn't we?
Well, you know, you know, Jack's still around. He still has the compass. You know.
Yeah, he'll always be around. So we'll see. We don't know what the future brings, and we'll see how well this movie does. But yeah, we like those little treats. It's also a part of the franchise, and we thought it was cool.
And so that's presumably Davy Jones, possibly, that we see at the end of the film. Can you comment on that?
Is there a question? It's not.
No, I'm just saying. I mean, you know, what's real and what's fantasy?
Yeah.
What is dream and what is
question?
Not.
Yeah. That's right. That's the question. Was it a dream?
We shall see in Pirates 6. Yeah. Davy Jones returns. Working title.
The Revenge of Davy Jones.
And the movie again. I'm not sure how openly this is known at the moment as we're recording this. But Brenton plays obviously Will and Elizabeth's son, Henry Turner. He's credited pretty much as Henry at the moment. I don't think people necessarily know that. Again, can you talk about that decision to make Henry Turner the focal point essentially of the movie, which is very much about fathers and sons and daughters and sons.
Yeah, it is a sort of a family theme in this movie too, and we do know that there's a lot of families going to see this movie together, and we want it to work for everybody. It was important for us to sort of go back to the way the first movie is made, where you have a young couple that's sort of driving the story, and then Jack crashed the party and where things start happening. And we wanted the same kind of structure because we felt that really works. Uh-huh. Also because Jack doesn't really have an arc. He's the guy he is, and
he's unchanging.
He's unchanging.
He's learned nothing.
He's learned nothing at the end of the movie.
He's
the same guy. So you need that some normal people in the middle, and then with all these crazy characters. And yeah, we were very happy to get Brenton aboard, and also Kaya Scodelario, obviously.
Yeah. At what point did you realize, as the story developed, that not only was Henry Will and Elizabeth's son, but that Karina was Barbossa's daughter? At what point did that come about?
This is so major spoiler. I hope you will put like the
these are major spoilers. Don't worry. This is out a long time. I think this podcast comes out in 2027.
Yeah, okay.
So don't worry about it. It's totally fine. It's totally fine.
You're gonna shelf it. Yeah. No. As you say, it is a strong theme in the movie, and I think that what we like about it, and you know, is that a treasure is not necessarily always a casket of gold, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's also something we can relate to. You know, we both have kids, and to be able to do a movie like this and a story like this for them. Mm-hmm. You know, and something that they can relate to, and it's also important. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why it's in there.
Was that a story point that you hit upon early, or was it something
yes,
that happened fairly late?
No, it was very early, and then we've been working on it for a long time. But we love Barbossa, mm-hmm. and we know the fans do too, and we really wanted to give him a great arc and a great ending. And we felt that this was very powerful, that we meet him at the beginning of the movie and he's a fat cat. He's got everything he ever wanted, but he's not happy.
Mm.
And I think there's a couple of reasons why he actually missed Jack.
Yeah.
And the Black Pearl, of course, but also there is a treasure that he hasn't really found yet. And, and he comes to realize that at the end of the movie. And we feel it's a really beautiful story for him.
Mm. And is he completely unaware that he has a daughter? I mean, he is. It's news to him when he discovers. He left his daughter at the... Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
he's aware of it. And I think that's also why he has maybe an emptiness inside of him, that he is aware of it. And, you know, that his victory as the king of all pirates now is a hollow one. You know?
Yes, of course. Yeah. It's a very interesting decision as well to give Barbossa such an emotional send-off. And, of course, again, major spoilers, a definitive ending. Is it definitive? I mean, this is a character that we've seen die before.
Exactly. He's died before. So we'll see. But we'll see. Yeah. We're not making all the decisions.
Okay. Can we talk about Salazar as well?
Sure.
He's a very interesting character. And there's a long stretch of the movie where I began to think of him as almost the equivalent of Ed Harris in The Rock. In that he's a bad guy who has a point. He's operating from a strange moral center, but he wants to wipe out pirates. And is that bad? I don't know necessarily.
It's a good
but
reference.
Yeah. But is yeah. it, can you talk about that character and the moral ambiguity of Salazar?
Yeah, no, I don't think bad guys believe that they are bad guys themselves. And we think...
That was certainly important for Javier.
Absolutely. And I think the reason why the bad guys or the villains in this franchise has worked so well also in the previous movies is because they do have a pain.
Mm-hmm.
They do have something human about them that we can relate to and understand.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes them have more dimensions that we appreciate. And we really wanted that for Javier Salazar too. Mm-hmm. So we worked really hard to make him layered.
Mm.
And to make him also relatable at a certain level.
Mm. And speaking of relatability, towards the end of the movie, when you make Salazar and his crew flesh and blood, for a second I thought you were going to redeem him totally. Did you discuss doing that? Did you want to push it in a different way and maybe keep him alive at the end of the film?
Yeah, I think that... it's not called Salazar's Revenge for nothing. we talked about a million things, you know, working on this script, of course, and
of course,
especially the resolution and Salazar's resolution. And I think that we landed on that his revenge. He still wanted revenge, even, you know, for those many, many years in hell.
Even in that few seconds where he's human.
Yeah.
Yeah, and how do you kill a guy that's already dead? you have to make him human again. So
okay.
Then you can kill him.
Yeah. Poor guy. Gets drowned again. I felt sorry for his second in command as well.
He gets stabbed and he gets his head smashed in. And then we drown him.
And then I drown him again. Yeah.
Just to make sure.
Yeah.
It's fairly definitive.
He'll come back.
Salazar's revenge again. That's number 7, working title. There's the idea that runs all the way through. Obviously, the MacGuffin in the movie is the Trident of Poseidon, and the opening image of the film is that sketch of Poseidon with the Trident.
Sure.
Given how insane these movies have been in the past, was there talk at any point of having Poseidon himself appear?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I think that, I mean, for us, it's, you know, we are definitely having, strong fantasy elements in the movie. But we tried to limit them somehow. it is. It's always going to be important for us to ground it, even a Pirates of the Caribbean, and I mean, that said, we have lots of fantastical elements, but I think that that was probably one of those things that, because it did have actually even more fantasy elements in some of the earlier drafts. And then we shaved them off a little bit because we felt it was enough of it, and mm-hmm. we wanted to concentrate more on the characters and not make it too fantastical and not bring in Poseidon at the top of that, you know, as the final boss.
Oh, now you're in trouble. Here's Poseidon. Yeah, okay, I get that.
Exactly.
The idea of the Trident of Poseidon, the idea of curses being built into it, and can you talk about that and where that came from as the overarching MacGuffin?
Well, I think that, you know, making a Pirates of the Caribbean, it's a blessing and a curse. no pun intended here, because there's such a vast mythology. Mm-hmm. In the series, in the franchise itself, and so it's tricky. It's choppy waters because on one side we need to honor that mythology and not step on anything that's already been promised or told, or you know, if there's a backstory for certain things or characters, you know, and there's been a lot of it. It's like, you know, 10, 11, 12 hours of film already made. Yeah. And then at the same time, it's important to bring new mythology into the story. And thanks to the brilliant Jeff Nathanson, our screenwriter that survived, I think, 4 years, you know, on this project, and helped us navigate through all of that. And thanks to him, you know, we are where we are now.
There's also the idea running through the film of the map that no man can read, that Karina can read, because obviously she's not a man. But there's the ruby at the end when they reach the island. Now, I read that means that perhaps Barbossa had been there before. Is that true, or am I misreading?
Well, I think that, he takes the ruby from her, from Karina, or the monkey takes the ruby from Karina on the Black Pearl. So that's how he has the ruby. And then I think that, again, having been a pirate for so many years, I think he's... has an intuition.
Okay, so it's not his necessarily.
No, maybe Galileo was there.
Okay, interesting. Yes,
it was on his book.
Yeah, so I think it's part of, like, you know, a combination of that.
Okay, interesting. Just to talk about Jack as well, because you say Jack doesn't change. Is that something that you guys wanted to make sure it happened in this film as well? He didn't change. He didn't learn from his mistakes.
No, people love Jack Sparrow.
Yeah.
And I think that they want Jack Sparrow the way he is. Mm-hmm. Because he stands for something that we can't have, but we sort of love. You know, that kind of freedom, that kind of to do whatever you want, and it won't really have any consequences. Mm-hmm. But we sort of at the same time wanted to learn more about him. Mm-hmm. And that's why we created this backstory mm-hmm. in the film. That was something that Joachim and I felt very strongly for, just to get a little peek into his backstory and also give the audience something that they didn't know already.
Mm. And you make a very conscious decision to tie in his backstory, his origin, essentially, with Salazar's origin.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, we feel that the revenge story will, of course, be much stronger if we've been a part of it. Mm-hmm. If we understand why Salazar is so pissed with him. And, at the same time, learn something about how Jack became Jack the Sparrow. We just thought that was really fun and interesting, and we wanted to see how it would play out.
Mm.
So, and also with today's technology, it's possible to do something like that. You know, we shot that with Johnny Depp, and then you know, spent almost a year youthifying him, as we say. You know, bringing him back to 21 Jump Street.
Yes,
Johnny Depp. You know,
they,
so
they can remake it now.
They can. They really can. It's scary. I don't know whether you guys have seen Guardians 2 yet.
No, and I haven't had a chance.
Russell
been
and
on
that.
The road.
Oh yeah,
equally freaky. We're at a very scary time right now. I wonder if it was the same effects house. Which effects house did
Lola.
That work?
Lola.
Same effects house. Yeah,
amazing.
They'll do well. All the actors can have comebacks now.
And it's a very interesting moment. So you in that moment you create Jack's nickname. Does that mean Jack Sparrow is not his real name? That he's been going by a nickname for the last 30
years? I think it was
30,
Jack the
years?
Cabin Boy.
Jack the Cabin Boy?
For a while.
That's his name? Okay. Okay. Yeah.
No, that's a joke.
I know.
It's the Sparrow name.
It is a nickname.
It is a nickname, yeah.
So what's his real name?
What's you have to ask name? Johnny about that.
Yeah. McCartney? Well, maybe there's another movie that will come with that answer.
Well, presumably Teague would be his name, right?
Yeah.
Jack Teague?
Or Teague Sparrow doesn't
Yeah,
sound
Teague,
right.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. You also have this this moment of where he's given his costume, which is very much almost like that the Clint Eastwood's Man with No Name getting his costume as he goes through The Good, the Bad, the Ugly.
I'm nodding approvally.
Was that a deliberate reference? Was that your nod at that point?
Yeah, and again, as Espen was saying, it's like it's so fun for us, sadly. I mean, we're fans of the franchise as well, and we just had so much fun with this, and you know, showing where he got his look, I also think it's a very sweet moment, you know, with his crew paying him tribute, and that's also where we start the movie, where after the failed bank heist, where he expects them to give him tribute.
Yes,
you know. Yeah. And then we go back to why he expects that. So.
Yeah, and that his journey becomes a part of him, also in a physical way, is really interesting. So it's part of creating the character, definitely.
Absolutely. You start Jack, though, at probably his lowest ebb in the five movies.
Yes.
I mean, so even though he doesn't change, there are obviously circumstances around him have changed. And there's almost a sense with Jack in this movie that he is a tragic figure. He really doesn't want anything to do with what is happening. He is, at some points, unaware of what is happening to him. He doesn't really have the connection with Salazar. He doesn't really remember him that much. That's a very interesting thread to pursue with this character. Can you talk about that and how much?
Sure. I mean, he's lost his mojo.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the Black Pearl. He's not even on sea anymore. So that's where we meet him, and we just felt that was an interesting place to start, because that would give him somewhere to go without, again, screwing with that character arc that doesn't exist. So we just felt it was an interesting setting to see him in, you know, on a ship on shore, like that time's equivalent of a trailer park.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think also the addition was to somehow show his, you know, proverbial wants and needs. You know, when he puts the Black Pearl trapped in the bottle on the railing of his shitty ship.
Yes.
And then kind of pretending that he sees it sailing on the horizon, you know. And that's, you're right. I don't think you've seen that kind of desire or want in Jack Sparrow before.
Mm. We wanted to do that because we also wanted the audience to feel for him, in a way. So it was just an interesting place to go with the character for us.
And then just two very, very last quick things. I wanted to talk about Jack's compass and at what point you guys and Jeff Nathanson decided that was going to be important as well. It's something that he's had with him for four movies.
Yeah.
And you suddenly now it becomes even more important than it has been in the past.
Yeah, I mean, you're touching on something that was probably the hardest nut to crack from a story point of view. It was something we spent a long time on because we needed some kind of element, some kind of a key to unlock Salazar from the his hellish prison in the triangle. And so that's a little bit where it started, actually, where, you know, what can we use and then what do we have? What kind of tools do we have? And we went back into the mythology, and of course the compass is one of the most prominent gadgets or whatever that Jax had or that everybody wants. So we just, you know, started from there, and it took a long time to kind of, you know, solve it. And, you know, where does it come in? And in the origin story, can we do it like this? Is there any other, you know, with the mythology of the compass, and does it work, and all of that? And hopefully you'll think we did crack it, you know, somehow.
Yeah, we sort of added the flip side, because everybody knew that the compass will point to what you want the most. And then we added the flip side that if you give it away, it will release your greatest fear. So
don't buy one in the gift shop and give it away.
Kind of classic that it comes with a warning.
Yeah.
As indeed do zombie sharks, which is the last thing I wanted to ask about. Zombie sharks. I don't really have a question. I just wanted to say zombie sharks.
Zombie sharks. Go and see that.
Didn't know you wanted them, but now you do.
Now they're here. All I can think about is zombie Jaws. I want to see Jaws 5 with zombie sharks. I want to see a crossover.
We wanted to create a new genre.
Yeah.
And you have. Congratulations. Well done, gents. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was Joachim Ronning and Espen Sandberg. That was them talking about their movie. And now it is us talking about the movie. And by us, of course, I mean myself, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And James Dyer.
Dyer.
Gar. Indeed. Now, where do we stand in this movie, people?
Well, I mean, I thought it was better than certainly the last one and probably the last two.
Okay.
Nowhere up near the level of the first one. I don't think any of the Pirate sequels have been, but I was at least entertained by lots of it. I liked quite a bit of the action. I thought they did a very good job with that. And I quite liked the young sort of lovers story this time around, but there was just so much going on that always kind of annoys me. I like my plots a little bit more streamlined, I think, so you've got more time for actual people. So this one had just so much, because you had Barbossa and you had Sparrow and you had Salazar, all with these competing aims, and David Wenham's person.
Oh, David Wenham.
Who definitely had a character. I mean, I just didn't need quite so many complications, I guess.
Yeah. James?
What on earth was it about? I have absolutely no clue. I followed at a distance, but it seemed very much to me the biggest problem with this film is it didn't have any internal logic whatsoever. Like, it didn't... the compass MacGuffin was clearly... They worked backwards to get that in there. Like, they clearly thought, we need a way to get him out of this curse. And, he's got a compass. It's magic. Let's use that. And,
so you've heard the interview then?
Is that, do they address
it's,
that?
It's not a million miles away. And, you know, you get the sense from the two of them that they may not have been 100% in charge of every decision made in the movie. But I thought they were well-intentioned. And I think a lot of the things that don't come off in the film, it's not for the want of trying.
Well, the road to pirate hell is paved with good intentions.
This is true.
And I don't think this is better than On Stranger Tides necessarily. I think it's in the same barnacle encrusted footlocker that thing resides in.
Oh, I think it's more recognisably pirates for me.
It's trying to be, but then you look at this and you look at the first movie and the contrast is stark, because the first movie is excellent, and certainly for my mind I feel a little bit like each one has got progressively worse. Like, I would take Dead Man's Chest and At World's End probably over this and Stranger Tides any day of the week. But it's all degrees by that point, isn't it? And I think the problem is it gets confused. The first one isn't hot on plot. The mythology isn't an essential part of it. But it keeps the things simple. It doesn't overcomplicate matters. And I think they've got increasingly Byzantine with, you know, the pirate hearts and ghosts and curses and magic items. And it's all this stuff, they kind of twist themselves in knots. Whereas it was quite simple, you know, it was a ghost pirate, a ship, zombies, a monkey, gold. Do you know what I mean? You didn't need to overcomplicate this. By this point, you've got a curse. You've got the Flying Dutchman, which is a curse. You've got a magic trident that does something telekinetic. I mean, there's so much in there. And then you've got a ghost pirate, except he's not a pirate. In fact, he hates pirates, but he is a ghost. And why are there so many zombie crew members just roaming the seas? Why is this a thing? It's very, very confusing for me.
Yeah. Poor James.
And Barbossa, he's alive, but he was dead. But he was dead at the beginning, but then they resurrected him, and now he's alive, but then he died. But will he come back again? Is he going to come back as a zombie? Will he come back as a pirate? Who knows?
But this is the thing. I mean, you know, I've talked before recently about my theory that every bad guy eventually becomes a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
It usually takes about 3 films. And well, what do you know?
That's essentially what it did with him. 3 films.
He actually not just becomes a quite good guy, he gets a heroic death, for God's sake.
Yeah. He does.
Ridiculous. Madness.
Yeah. I just also, Brendan Thwaites didn't really feel like he had a lot to do. I mean, you could cut him out of this film and quite happily, I would think, and it would, you know, toddle along nicely without him. I don't think you need him. Kaia Scodelario, I thought, was quite good. I don't think she had a great deal to work with, but I think she herself is good.
I actually thought Thwaites did quite a good job, I have to say.
Really?
Yeah, I found it
very bland. He's the ready salted crisps of this film, I thought.
I quite like a ready salted crisp now and again.
That speaks I bet you eat vanilla ice cream as well, don't you?
I mean, only with things. You don't have vanilla on it.
Is he a crisp or is he a kettle chip?
I don't know the difference.
Nor do I.
Okay. It's like I'm not following your metaphor.
Well, kettle chips are slightly more expensive versions of crisps that you buy in pubs.
Well, I mean, so we've got the original kettle chip, I guess, in this, in the shape of Orlando Bloom.
We do,
and
don't we?
I did really like the little scene at the beginning where, you know, the sort of the 10-year-old Henry goes out to meet his dad. I thought that was really nicely played, and it was actually quite emotional, and it gave that character a little bit of heft that he wouldn't otherwise have had. I really liked that.
Explain to me that sequence. Because that you may end up explaining the entire film to me, so because I don't understand.
Henry figures out where the Flying Dutchman is, and he knows that his dad is on there, because at the end of the end of Pirates of the Caribbean 3, if you remember, Will has taken on the curse of Davy Jones, and he is condemned to be the captain of the Flying Dutchman.
Yes.
Which means he can only step upon land once every 10 years. So the end of that is Will going off to meet Elizabeth Swan for some hot rumpy pumpy, and old one-shot Will there manages to, you know.
Yes, I got how reproduction works.
Okay,
I understood.
Right,
that was covered a while ago. But so he drops an anchor and he gets on the deck.
Basically he threatens to, he almost drowns himself, so his dad turns up to kind of rescue him. So that's what's happening. Yeah.
Right, because he touches the deck and the ship comes up. Why is the ship, and then the ship goes down again. Why is the ship going down again? I wondered if there were rules here that I just wasn't aware of.
No, I think his dad just can't like hang out forever, basically, because he's not allowed to by the curse, is the idea. That's what I sort of took from it. I thought that was a nice little scene. And then that sets up his sort of obsessive quest.
Yeah.
And then that gives him something in common with Karina, even though she's coming at it from a completely different angle. Or thinks she is. What do you know?
I liked the aspect of tying it into Will and Elizabeth and the idea of the curse. And that was all fun and games. What it does, of course, is set up a really confusing timeline, because it's roughly, 20 years on from the end then of At World's End. So you're looking, 25 years maybe on from the end of the first Pirates, maybe?
I don't think there's that much time between the first and third Pirates. I think they're fairly close together. And I think she was knocked up at the end of the, as it were. She was basically pregnant already when he gets the curse. So when you see him coming back after 10 years...
Oh, so he's not coming up to...
No, when he comes back after 10 years, the kid's already a kid. So she's still only about 36, 37, I think.
All right. So Jackson is what, late 40s, early 50s or so in this film. And the interesting thing about this film is, I thought that the directors are very interested on it, is Jack Sparrow. Because I think the film begins to lose momentum the minute he comes into it. And this is not the case, obviously, with the previous Pirates of the Caribbean films. Certainly not the case with the first one, where he drives the plot in a really weird, idiosyncratic, Jack Sparrow-ish way. In this one, I don't think this is the Jack Sparrow we met back in the first movie. And Sandberg and Ronning were talking about essentially how they feel that Jack Sparrow shouldn't change, that he should be the same person at the end of the movie as he is at the beginning of the film.
I actually agree with that.
Whether you agree with that, okay, that's interesting. My point is that the person he is at the beginning of the film is not the person he should be.
I will also agree with that.
Okay, we're done here then. Let's move on.
And that was the Empire podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
No, but I think you're right. I think Jack Sparrow is not somebody who changes. He's like Seinfeld. He doesn't learn. No learning.
No hugs.
He just, that's what he is. That's what he does. He keeps on keeping on. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right. I think the Jack Sparrow we meet in this film is not Jack Sparrow as of the first film. And I don't know that he's been that Jack Sparrow in a little while. I don't think he necessarily was in Stranger Tides either. I think that's one of the problems with that film as well. But here, you're right, he doesn't particularly have a scheme. He doesn't particularly have a plan. He doesn't particularly have his own goal, really, it doesn't feel like.
No.
He's just hanging out.
What he is actually quite a sad tale. When we meet him, and I don't know whether this was deliberate, but when we meet him, this character played, of course, by Johnny Depp, is penniless, broke, mm-hmm. likes his wine. His advisors are turning their backs on him. Kind of weird. Anyway,
I don't know if there's any resemblance to anything
that could happen in real life. But this isn't the same Jack Sparrow. This is quite a sad cautionary tale. This is a man in his late 40s, early 50s, who's a bit of a soak, who's not really getting on with his life. He's desperately questing after past glories, but he doesn't have the wherewithal to make it happen. And I felt a little bit sorry for him, to be honest. And I do wonder whether the fact that this isn't written by Ted Elliott and Terry Rossio might have contributed to that. It feels a bit to me like John McClane in Die Hards 4 and 5. Mm-hmm. Still the same person playing him, but
not the same character.
Something slightly off about it.
Yeah.
And it never quite recovers from that.
They were always quite clear that he was meant to be like a Figaro character, like he's meant to be the trickster. And there's not a whole lot of tricking in this at all, really. I mean, the closest you get really is in the flashback to him as a, you know, teenage cabin boy or whatever the heck he's meant to be in that sequence.
Yeah.
You're right. Not great. Yeah. Can we skip to the end for a second?
Let's skip to the end.
Can we skip to the post-credit scene?
Of course we can.
Because we're pretty clear that destroying the Trident of Poseidon has broken all the curses.
Yes.
Why the buggering heck, then, do we see what appears to be Davy Jones' shadow? What's up with that?
Yeah,
it's almost as if they haven't thought it through.
I mean, but assuming they have.
What, remind me, what happened to Davy Jones at the end of At World's End?
As you can see, we prepared for this by rewatching all the Pirates
movies.
He was
like super dead.
He's dead. So maybe death was his curse and it's now broken.
No, but like
back.
He was dead because his heart had been destroyed. So he was kept alive because his heart was in a box, basically. And if his heart, and then his heart was like his weak point. If somebody actually stabbed the heart, then he'd die. And then they did. And so he died.
But maybe, but here's the thing. If it is him at the end of the post-credit sting.
Well, who else has a beard that kind of has tentacles? Yes.
And of course, you know, Ronnie and Sandberg were basically like, oh, it could be, maybe. Yes, it's him. But why would he just disappear? Why would he just go to where Will and Elizabeth are sleeping, watch them like a really creepy pervert, and then just leave again, but leaving, his teeth or bits of his tentacles on the floor? Anyway.
I mean, like, no, Will and Elizabeth did, they were the ones to stab its heart with Jack.
Yeah.
So, that would be a reason to come for them.
But why not just kill them?
Maybe he's about to, and then it just stops too soon.
Maybe he only lives in the dream world now.
Oh,
maybe
good Lord.
Let's think about that. Maybe
he's like Freddy.
He's like Freddy. All
right. That's not.
Yeah, there's a number of questions I have about things like Barbossa's timeline and, you know, the redemptive arc. I quite like the fact that he had a redemptive arc. I mean, I know it's a little bit predictable, but Geoffrey Rush is a really good actor and he deserves something to do in these movies. And I thought he brought it. I thought he sold it because it was introduced so late in the day. You kind of almost feel that Jack Sparrow is going to be revealed as her dad. And then the movie kind of goes, oh, Barbossa's here as well. And makes it work, just about.
I think I always thought it was going to be Barbossa, but that may be because I'd read about an earlier draft of the script where it was openly Barbossa's daughter. So
okay,
yeah. I do like Barbossa.
Yeah, he's good. He also feels massively overused in this series. Like he was the villain of the first one. He was very much a supporting character, after that, and he keeps kind of just clinging on to more and more screen time. Maybe it's just because everybody loves Geoffrey Rush, and I suppose I can't blame them. But
he does the best authentic pirate voice. I think that's his. Oh, here's an interesting fact. Do you know why all pirates sound like they come from Bristol?
Because they all did.
Well, funnily enough, that is actually kind of true, and I actually read up on this. During the golden age of piracy, it said on a website, which was almost certainly true, in the late 17th and early 18th century, many English pirates came from this region. Look up famous sea dogs from the era, and you'll find the birthplaces in Bristol, Devon, and Cornwall. But of course, that isn't the reason. It's because the most famous screen pirate from around the 50s was Robert Newton, who was from Dorset, and he had a thick West Country accent, and he was in Treasure Island, and Blackbeard the Pirate, and Long John Silver, and a bunch of other stuff, and because he sounded like he's from the West Country, though I clearly don't, that's why people think pirates are. So that's the thing. Well, although an extra layer to this,
oh my God,
is yeah, I've gone down the rabbit hole. Long John Silver and Blackbeard were apparently from that part of the world, so it was also quite authentic.
Can we make you walk the plank?
You can.
You that told wasn't... me off for talking too much about Wonder Woman.
I'm just
my
saying,
God,
I
man.
Thought that was a that's, really interesting yeah. fact. That may be on my own.
If you want to hear James tell Helen off for talking too much about Wonder Woman, that's in a different podcast. That's in this week's regular podcast. Go and check that one out. Okay, let's take some very, very quick questions from the readers. I do sense a general disdain for this film, a general sense of apathy towards this film, as evidenced by the fact we got very, very few questions. Literally, the first one was, and I'm not kidding, what's wrong with Johnny Depp? Oh, come on.
Come on, we don't have that long.
This one's from Scott Clark. Where does the pod team think pirates can go? It feels like this is just the same. It's bad pirates versus Captain Jack and the English cavalry get involved. I mean, where can I go? I mean, I was actually a little bit disappointed that there was a post-credit sting, I'll be honest with you, because it felt to me like this was an end.
Yes, I agree. It all felt like, well, that's everything wrapped up. We can all go home now. And then they have that bloody scene. So I was disappointed by that. I think if they're going to go on, they should try and do something a bit more interesting. I mean, Black Sails on TV at the moment has quite a lot of female pirates. That might mix things up a bit. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just talking about the sort of the Penelope Cruz character last time, who was dreadful.
But where was she? Where was she this time? There's not even a mention of her.
I mean, anyway, I don't know where to go, but I would certainly try and restore the Captain Jack that we have vaguely heard about. And I would maybe have some actual treasure hunting or piracy. That might be quite cool, I think.
Because I do get, I've spoken to a lot of people about this movie, and they go, oh, Johnny Depp's doing Jack Sparrow again. And I think they've forgotten what he was like the first time.
Mm.
2003, what a breath of fresh air that character was. The guy was nominated for an Oscar, for God's sake, for that performance. He's amazing in that film. And he was so surprising, so idiosyncratic, and so smart, and always a step ahead of everybody he was up against. And I just want that guy back again.
The problem is, Pirates movies are Jack Sparrow, but we've had enough of it. It's just not funny anymore. It's old hat now. I don't think there's much you can do with this franchise at this point to actually make it good. I really don't.
Don't say that, because then they'll try to reboot it.
Well, isn't it? Orlando Bloom was saying that he thought that's what the plan was going to be. That they were going to try and reboot. Just don't do it. Just let it die. Do something else. There are many, many other rides at Disney World. Pick one. Space Mountain,
it's
the movie.
Small world,
well, yeah.
Did anyone think it was weird that Jack didn't go on shore to say hello to Will and Elizabeth? I mean, I know.
They shot it in England. He didn't come over. I think that's the main reason.
Yeah. He had his dogs, Pistol and Boo, on the ship with him. He couldn't bring him in. Farry asks, why doesn't Keira Knightley speak? What's that about?
Oh, I don't know.
It's a legitimate question. Would they have had to pay her more? Is there like a, is there a contractual thing there?
That's
a
genuine feeling in that, yeah. That, you know, yes. And also she can only say, as we know, my name is Domino Harvey. So
I'm a bounty hunter.
I'm a bounty hunter. Where was Bootstrap Bill? Where is he? Where's Stellan Skarsgård? Give us Stellan Skarsgård, you monsters.
Okay.
That was from Chris 80, by the way. That wasn't just me randomly saying something. All right. A lot of the questions we got sent in are people saying, should they call it a day? I got a number of variations, sadly, because I don't think this film's a bad film. I think it's okay. You know, it's fine in places. It goes off the rails in others. We got a lot of people saying, why? Simply. And the question, the answer to that, of course, is that the last one made over $1 billion.
Yeah.
And they were hoping to do the same with this one. It doesn't look as if they're going to, but there you go. Should we talk about Paul McCartney? Timo Matt asks, as Keith Richards and Paul McCartney are pretty good on guitar and bass, which aging drummer should join them in Pirates 6? My vote goes to Ringo Starr. I mean, that would make sense, wouldn't it, James? How many drummers do you know, James?
Okay, how about all of the Spinal Tap drummers as ghost pirates?
Just exploding on air. Just, you know, it'd boom, be amazing. Boom, boom, boom. Ringo's the obvious choice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah? Lovely Ringo. James, can you name a drummer? You're yes. looking at me with such an air of yes. panic.
Mr. Drums, the drummer from the band that I like. That one.
You like band, you like music. I don't understand this.
Chris Cornell started out as a drummer before he became a vocalist and guitarist.
Well, Dave Grohl.
Dave Grohl.
Dave Grohl. Meg White, isn't she? Drums.
He's actually...
look at that.
Yeah.
Who's what?
I was just thinking, Dave Grohl's done some acting here and there. He's done some cameos.
Yeah. Yeah, he played the devil in Tenacious D and The Pick of Destiny. He's been in The Muppets. And, I think he's got the chops and the charm and the charisma.
Okay, stick with me here.
Okay.
Right? A crossover.
Oh,
right?
No. Yeah.
Pirates of the Caribbean,
Colon,
Muppet Treasure Island. I think I've just solved it. You're welcome.
Can
I jump in with another one of my fascinating facts?
Yes, go on then.
You ready? Okay. On Stranger Tides, obviously wasn't originally a Pirates thing. It's a fancy book by, what's his name? Tim Powers. And that is the book that inspired the Monkey Island video games.
Wow.
Fact. Guybrush Threepwood.
Pirates of the Caribbean, colon, Monkey Island.
I'd absolutely, that would also work. Without a doubt, watch that.
I have to say, and I said this to the directors as well, and they agreed with me, that Dead Men Tell No Tales, the original subtitle of this movie, is a much better subtitle than Salazar's Revenge.
Yes.
Because in the months before this film is opening, you're looking at it going, who the hell's Salazar? Yeah. And why does he want revenge? Yeah. And the movie doesn't really, I think, satisfactorily answer both of those questions.
It really doesn't. Who was he? And yeah, he has a part, he passingly encounters Jack Sparrow, ends up in prison. It's very thin. Very, very thin. Mm. I wanted a little bit of backstory there and understanding if you know why he was the scourge of pirates and whatnot. Mm. I think it's kind of, you get that little flashback sequence which broadly covers it. Mm. But it's a bit of an odd thing.
I did like the way his ship ate other ships, though. I thought that was cool.
But it didn't, though. You know, it opened in the kind of, in a sort of Moonraker style-y.
It was more like, I think it was meant to be more like a shark.
Well, he just kind of squashed them, didn't it? Because he didn't actually consume them. They just kind of...
No, I'm not literally eating, but like...
If it had become a bigger ship every time,
that would have been cool.
Yeah. I think they need to go back and reshoot that now. Mm. I liked his hair.
Whose hair?
Javier Bardem's hair.
Swishy
yes.
hair.
Yes.
Yeah,
it
swishy.
Was, it was pretty swishy. That was
I like
cool.
the idea that he was always drowning.
Yeah.
He was always underwater, even when he was above land. I really liked that.
Not waving.
Yeah, precisely. Rubber Shark on Twitter says, are studios overusing the de-aging technology? Seems like they're shoehorning it in now. I don't think Disney are going, hey guys, we're doing it in Pirates of the Caribbean. Are you doing it, Marvel? Yes, we're doing it. Okay, what about you, other studio?
But it is one company that does it, isn't it?
It's a company called Lola, yeah.
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 A few other people have been touching on it now as well. It's not just Lola. Mm. ILM, I know, can do it as well. Yeah. But
Lola have done... This year alone, they did Guardians, and they did this as well, and they've done all the Marvel de-aging, so they're very, very good at it. I don't know if they're overusing it. I think it's actually opening a new path for them to go down Retcon Alley, which is interesting. I don't know if it entirely worked in this one. The CG in this one didn't blow me away as much as young Kurt Russell in Guardians 2, but still good.
He needed a younger voice. The voice didn't work. For how youthed he was.
Right.
I think that I bumped on that. It bugged me. He needed his voice needed youthing as well. Perhaps there's a niche for another company that youths voices.
Yeah, maybe there is. I mean, you know, that's meant to be young Keith Richards he meets at the end as well, Captain Teague. Obviously, Keith Richards wasn't available, so that's why they got Paul McCartney in. But, you know, a de-aged Keith Richards is something beyond the abilities of any CG software at the moment. So, I quite... Don't have a huge problem with it.
What did you think of the zombie sharks?
Oh my God, yes, the zombie sharks. The best thing ever. Amazing.
I mean, like the worst thing ever, but, you know, in an exciting way.
Are we seeing a spin-off? Zombie Sharknado?
What a terrifying prospect.
Tagline, anything can happen.
Yeah.
Oh,
I was slightly surprised that... Good one. I was surprised that Salazar, whose entire existence seemed to be about killing this man that he met for 30 seconds from 500 feet away years and years ago, this man who doesn't remember him, I thought it was an interesting twist that Jack Sparrow has no idea what's happening in this film. He has no idea the plot is happening to him or because of him at any point. He just seems oblivious to the whole thing. But Salazar's whole existence is about getting his revenge. It even tells you in the title. And it's quite helpful that way. And yet he's willing to give the job of actually killing Jack Sparrow to, like, anyone else. Like, zombie sharks.
Dead shark,
yeah,
sure.
Zombie shark, you go and kill him. I will not get the satisfaction from this that I want. I thought it was a bit strange. But otherwise, zombie sharks, yes.
Yeah. Wedding scene, weirdo wedding scene, who's super no. Really gross, hated it.
Which one?
The wedding scene. Do you remember?
Was
he was kidnapped
that?
And tried to marry off to somebody's ugly sister.
Oh, yes, yes,
it
yes.
It was genuinely the worst thing I think I've seen in any of these films.
I think that's fair, actually.
I wanted
it was
to burn
dreadful.
The print. It was horrible.
Very, just, very strange.
Just no.
Very strange. All right. So, not a lot of questions left.
Okay.
And I don't think there's really a lot of, really much else to talk about with this film, which is a bit of a shame, I would say. But someone has said that, you know, there are some really good set pieces, as you say. You know, I love that guillotine gag with Jack Sparrow.
Yeah, that was clever.
Constantly, the you know, getting close to having his head cut off.
The bank gag is good as well, the kind of Fast Five thing, even if he's a little bit laboured.
Yeah. Well, someone else, Nigel Saunders on Twitter, has said, after the blatant rip-off of Fast Five's Fault Theft, what other aspects of the Fast and Furious franchise can make the switch to the Pirates movies? Now, obviously, the Staith. The Staith would reinvigorate any aging alien franchise and give it a bit of, you know, yo, watcha.
Yes, you're that right. Would be acceptable.
Yeah.
We've only seen them in the Caribbean. Maybe they should go up north and have a battle in the ice. No, not really.
giant submarine.
Giant submarine. That's what I'm thinking. You know?
Yeah? You like that?
No, I'm not. No, that's a terrible idea, Chris.
It's not my idea.
I'm just saying it's a terrible idea of mine. It's fine. Yeah, what else could they steal? I mean, just like all of it, you know, jumping out of an exploding ship, I guess. They kind of did that almost in number three. The Tom Holland death scene was, you know, somebody walking calmly, quietly through an exploding ship. So maybe Fast Six stole
Fast
that
six.
From them.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, you can't do the skyscrapers thing.
Can't you?
No. Well, you'd need some really, really tall palm trees.
Yeah. So boats crashing out of buildings.
Yeah.
Into other buildings.
Well, there. I mean, I'm not familiar entirely with the geography of the Caribbean, but there do seem to be an awful lot of very spiky rocks, so I wonder if they can do something more with those.
Yeah.
People clambering over them and down them and that kind of thing.
Do you think this is it? Do you think this is it? I mean, it doesn't look like it's going to make a billion.
If the reports of it costing $230 million to make are correct, which is not beyond the realm of possibility, given that this had quite a protracted production schedule, at the moment, it's doing what for any other film would be an extremely respectable 366 nearly million at the moment worldwide. That's not bad by any stretch of the imagination, but it's possibly not good enough to sustain that kind of a budget. So what we might see is it rebooted a little bit at a lower level.
Like a Pintle and Rigetti spin-off. Yeah?
Well,
Pintle and, you know, Lee Arenberg and Mackenzie Crook, notable by their absence in this one. My understanding of this is that Crook didn't want to do it because he's doing what's his TV show, The Detectorist.
Yeah.
And I think Arenberg was a little bit disappointed that he didn't get to because of it.
So they only come in pairs, is that
apparently?
Is that,
yes, they're a double act.
I enjoyed the double act that replaced him. I thought they were quite fun actually.
What, Stephen Graham and Kevin McNally?
Stephen Graham's been in it for ages, and so is Kevin McNally.
But they were both kind of bumped up a little bit.
The double act that replaced him were... Oh, by the way, Bruce Spence is in this movie, which surely further cements his claim to be the box office champ of all time, because now he's been in Star Wars, Lord of the Rings. He is the guy, Mayor Dix, you know, the guy that Jack Sparrow wakes up in the safe with the guy, and he goes, "Oh, that's my wife! Oh no,
I missed that."
Yeah, so that's Bruce Spence, and he's been in Mad Max and all sorts of stuff, and so he's been in loads and loads of movies that have made lots and lots of money, which is a which is lovely for him. Because there were two guys. One of them was from like Playaway or Playdays or something, like a TV show I used to watch growing up as a kid. And they were like the two buffoonish pirates who were brought in to replace Mackenzie Crook. And what's the other guy's name?
Lee Arenberg.
I thought they were quite fun, actually, the sort of, you know, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of the movie. David Wenham completely wasted, sadly.
Really?
Bit of a shame.
What was the purpose? That he had no impact on the plot at all?
Yeah, bit of a shame. But, you know, overall, enjoyable enough, better than the last one. If it is to be the final one, it's not quite a high, but you take it.
Yeah.
Okay. So there we go. That is it for our Pirates of the Caribbean, Salazar's Revenge, or Dead Men Tell No Tales, whatever title you want to put on it, spoiler special. Our next spoiler special will be for The Mummy, and that is going to be with the director of that film, Alex Kurtzman. Helen has seen The Mummy. She is heavily mumbargoed.
I am, yes.
But that's going to be coming out on June 12th. That's when The Mummy's going to be out, spoiler special. After that, the next one's going to be Baby Driver? I think Baby Driver's the next one with Edgar Wright. So all very, very exciting. If you like our spoiler specials, keep your eyes peeled for those, ears peeled for those. This is a podcast. And also, we're not doing a Wonder Woman spoiler special per se, certainly not a podcast, but we will be doing something. So check our Facebook and Twitter feeds, both Empire Magazine and our individual feeds for news of that. That'll be next week. And of course, if you don't already listen to the regular podcast, it's out every Friday. So do check that out and subscribe to iTunes if you don't already. Right, that is it. Thank you to James Dyer.
You're welcome.
It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara. And it's goodbye for me. I'm off to splice the main brace. But first, I'm going to Google splice the main brace. I believe it's something to do with hacking. So, looking forward to that. Thanks for listening. I've been Chris Hewitt. See you next time.